Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Okay, so I guess we go as long as we go, is it? This is the last night, so. So if this is a questions and answers, then who has a question? Maharaj.
Good question. Well, I mentioned it that it was an opportunity for us to deepen our direct relationship with Srila Prabhupada, but maybe you can tell us how we can do that to those of us who've never met him in person.
Well, our experience is that your relationship with the spiritual master is deepened by acting on his instructions. I mean, I saw that practically during Prabhupada's time, and we've realized it, I think, a lot more practically since Prabhupada's disappearance, that the relationship is meaningful if you actually act on the instructions and advice that you receive. And if you don't do that, then it remains superficial. So in that sense, because Prabhupada, he had one intention, and that was to free us from the material world. That was his sole purpose, you know, in writing his books and coming to the West and working so hard, traveling all over the world, meeting so many people. It's just to give anybody that would hear an opportunity to transform their lives. So there were many people that heard from Srila Prabhupada but didn't take up the call. They didn't really hear what he had to say, and they didn't act on it, and so they didn't experience the transformation that many of us did experience by working hard in Krishna consciousness and absorbing ourselves in Prabhupada's instructions. So it's a very practical thing. It's not an intellectual exercise, you know, that you just... And there were people that came just for some intellectualism. Prabhupada met many, many people, professors and scholars, scientists, politicians, so many others. And for most of them, it was an intellectual exercise. They would come, ask a few, you know, cursory questions, and then go away, and, you know, they wouldn't, nothing would happen. There would be no effect from it. But there were many others. They would hear a few words from Srila Prabhupada. They would absorb that in their hearts, and they would immediately act on it. So deepening our relationship with Prabhupada, making it meaningful, it means acting on his instructions. And because he repeated that many times, I heard him repeat it many times, that serving the, you know, the body is one thing that's required, but serving the instruction, that is actually the real level of, you know, relationship. There was one time actually when we were in Sanand in Gujarat. This was probably about the 27th or 28th of December in 1975. So Sanand, Gujarat, it's a small town. It's about 21,000 population, or at least in those days it was. Maybe it's a lot bigger now. It's about an hour or so outside of Ahmedabad in Gujarat. So Prabhupada had been invited to hold a pandal there for about 5 days by the Maharaj of Sanand. Nice man, old portly gentleman, big white beard, big red turban. And he had this inclination to invite sadhus to come and stay at Sanand Palace and then hold programs for the, you know, rest of the population to take advantage of. So I'm not exactly sure how the connection was first taken up, but Prabhupada went there on Christmas Day in 1975, and we stayed up until the end of the month, and we had a very wonderful pandal program. About 5,000 or 6,000 people were coming every single night, and they were also having gatherings in the mornings as well. So during that period, Srila Prabhupada was discussing with Hari Kesh Das Brahmachari at that time, how to defeat communist philosophy. It was something that he was doing with him all through December and January. For not any apparent reason, he was just, somehow or another, they started discussing about communist philosophy and just the whole idea about chemical evolution. And Prabhupada would call Hari Kesh into his room and he would hammer out all the questions and answers to do with evolution, how to defeat the evolutionary theory. In fact, one of the examples that he often cited was how he had come here to South Africa just a couple of months before this. And he had seen, there were two things I remember that he commented on. One was the massive chicken farms, yeah, that they had. And, you know, how they were dealing with them so cruelly. But he took from that the example of the chicken and the egg, which I'll mention more about in a minute. And then he also mentioned how in the Indian Quarter, then they were keeping a slaughterhouse, cows, just right close by, just to provoke the Indian community, because they knew the Hindus didn't like to kill cows. So they had, government had put a slaughterhouse just nearby, maybe in Durban, I guess it was. And he said, during the night time you could hear, you know, all the cows screaming as they were being killed. So like that, he said, he was commenting how merciless and cruel they were. But anyway, he, with Hari Kesh, was going over this, you know, material philosophy, material scientific philosophy, and giving the pointers how to defeat it. One of the arguments that he would repeat was how, you know, the chicken lays an egg, and then the egg incubates, and then after only a few days, then you get another chicken. So he said, make this challenge to the scientists that here, you take some yellow substance and you take some clear substance, here's some plastic, you make a shell, and then incubate it and see if you can produce a chicken. Yeah? You claim that life comes from chemicals, so here are all the chemicals you can analyze. You put all the chemicals together and you put them in a nice plastic shell, and then let's see if you can produce another chicken. And if you cannot produce, he said, then the chicken is better scientist than you are. Like that. And he said, there, you should give the Nobel Prize to the chicken. So like this, he was challenging in so many different ways. And when we were in Sanand, in particular, Hari Kesh had got a small book, which was a summary of Marxist-Leninist philosophy. And so he was reading that, and then one afternoon when I was giving Prabhupada his massage on the roof, then Hari Kesh came up with the recorder and then he started discussing Marxist philosophy, especially on this point about thesis, antithesis and synthesis. And then Prabhupada explained that same process but in spiritual terms, that the thesis is that there's the soul, the antithesis is that there's the body, and the synthesis is how the two can actually work together or be utilized together for spiritual development. So he described all this, very nice conversation at the end of it. Then Hari Kesh, you know, said, and then Prabhupada told him, he said, now you write all this up. Yeah. So then Hari Kesh said, well, there's nothing left to say, you've already smashed all the opposition. Said, you've spoken so wonderfully. And so he was praising Srila Prabhupada. So then Prabhupada said, that's all right. He said, you can praise your Guru Maharaj, and your Guru Maharaj may be pleased. Oh, he's offering me some flowers and, you know, like, and some puja. But he said, if you really want to praise your Guru Maharaj, then you go and preach this vigorously. Challenge them. He said, then you'll actually praise your Guru Maharaj. He said, because it's nice if you offer some fruits and flowers. But the real praise means you go out and you preach this philosophy. So if we actually claim a relationship with Srila Prabhupada, as he also, he got a nice letter on his Vyasa Puja in 76 from Los Angeles, the devotees in Los Angeles. And Prabhupada said, yes, he said, if you want to please me, then do as I am doing. Go out and preach. So Prabhupada was very practical. You know, flowery words are one thing. Anybody can speak anything. But actual action shows that there's some realization, and that's what Srila Prabhupada wanted. And he many times said that I'm confident this movement will go on because the young people of your country have taken it. So because you have taken it seriously, then he said, I'm confident that it will go on after I leave. And another time he said, don't make me an Alexander. Yeah, Alexander the Great. Go in, conquer a city, leave, and immediately lose it. So he said, don't make me an Alexander. It said, at least maintain what I've given you if you can't expand it. So there are many, many instructions like that, but everything was orientated to very practical action. And that was what Prabhupada took to be the symptom of our, you know, proper understanding. And our development of our relationship was based on practical things. You know, not just, as I say, some intellectualism, but actually doing things, manifesting it, not just sitting down, as he said, and snoring and eating and sleeping and making out that you're a great devotee, but actually going out and vigorously pushing forward the movement of Lord Chaitanya. So if we want to realize anything about Srila Prabhupada and understand anything about Srila Prabhupada, the best way to do that is to study very carefully his books and enact the instructions that are there. And as soon as we do that, then immediately spiritual life becomes alive. It becomes life, spiritual life. But if we just read but never do anything about it, then, as he says in Nectar of Devotion, then you cannot, he said, without going out on the Sankirtan party, he said, simply reading is not enough. It's only when you actually join the Sankirtan party that you can assimilate the words that are in the scriptures. But just reading them, there's no assimilation. You want to add that?
I would ask a question.
Oh. I thought you were going to say something.
Well, yes, I have a question. Do you recall hearing Srila Prabhupada speaking about service and separation to the spiritual master compared to direct personal association and direct personal service?
Well, of course, we heard many things. When I was with him, I mean, my practical experience was that Prabhupada preferred us to be out preaching. You know, he did say anybody can do personal service. That's not a, you know, it's not a complex thing. But to go out and actually preach, that's what Prabhupada really wanted. And when I remember one occasion when he was speaking with Guru Kripa Maharaj in his room, and they were talking about some kind of managerial business in Hawaii, and Guru Kripa Zone was Hawaii in Japan at that time. And so while they were discussing, I was sitting at the back of the, you know, Prabhupada's room. And it was always my habit, whenever Prabhupada was talking to anybody, then I was in the room with him. And anyway, this particular occasion, I was sitting there and I was thinking, well, Prabhupada's, you know, they're talking about this particular managerial stuff that concerns Guru Kripa. So I was kind of not really paying attention. And I was poking around in my pockets and I found a toothpick. So I, you know, just pulled the toothpick out and I just very idly started to poke my teeth with it. So Srila Prabhupada was talking to Guru Kripa, but as he was talking with him, he had one eye on him and he had the other eye on me. And then he stopped and he said, what is this? He said, I'm speaking. He said, I'm not just speaking for him. He said, this is for you also. Although I had nothing to do with his zone or that managerial thing. But he said, I'm speaking for you also. Listen. He said, "You're always playing with your hands and nose." I had this habit of pulling skin off my fingers and stuff. So now, go and wash. Like this. Made me go and wash my hands because I've been playing with a toothpick. But the point there was that Prabhupada was saying, this is not just for him, this is for you also. In other words, all the instructions that Prabhupada was giving, they were for everybody. And he expected us to go out and act on them. And, when I was with Prabhupada, when I joined his party, I was kind of a very young devotee. I was only 24. No, just 25. I just turned 25 the week before. And I've been in the movement about 3.5 years. I was an ordinary devotee. I wasn't, of any distinction whatsoever. But when I left the party in 1977 in March, then, I was kind of going through a whole mental trauma about just leaving the party and what I would do. I didn't actually really want to leave the party, but I kind of came to a point where I recognized that my time was up. And, that I should go out and do something. And so when I mentioned it to Srila Prabhupada that I felt like I needed a break, I had a plan. I was going to just stay in India and hang out because I knew that Prabhupada spent most of his time in India. And then after having a month or two's break, just to kind of freshen up, because I felt like I was getting a bit stale in doing the personal service and I was making small mistakes and being inattentive. And so I didn't want that to grow to a point where I actually committed some serious offenses. So I thought I'd better take a break and then get, freshened up a little bit by doing something else. And then if I'm still in India, I can hang out and then come back on the party again. So that was my plan. But when I spoke with Srila Prabhupada and I said, I think I need a break. I don't want to commit offenses. Prabhupada, when I said that, Prabhupada said, yes, very good. He was very happy that I was at least sufficient presence of mind to realize that, I may commit offenses by being inattentive and that I didn't want to do that. So he was happy that I kind of understood that. But the first thing he said was then, well, what are you going to do? And I, for some reason or another, I hadn't expected Prabhupada to ask me, what are you going to do? I was thinking, I'll just, go to Bombay or some other temple and find something to do. But he asked me, what are you going to do? So then I said, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. So then he suggested, he asked me, he said, well, what about Hyderabad? And Hyderabad was probably the last place on earth that I wanted to go. Because we'd been down there a couple of times and I'd seen what was happening and I really didn't think I would fit in there. But anyway, I kind of gulped and I said, well, if you really want me to go down there, I'll go. I said, I'm not particularly attracted to it, but if you want me to go, I'll do whatever you want me to do. So he said, no. He said, I'm just, asking, that's all. So he said, all right, we'll think about it later. So then he didn't say anything the rest of the day. And then in the evening, I told Tamal Krishna Maharaj, who had just come on as the personal secretary, permanent, that I was going to leave the party, that I'd spoken with Srila Prabhupada, and he had agreed. And so he was a little surprised, but then he said, well, okay, what are you going to do? Because he had been trained by Prabhupada, so he was in the same mold. So he said, what are you going to do? So I said, well, I don't know, I have no idea. Maybe I might go down to Bombay and do something with Giriraj or something, college preaching or whatever. So then he said, well, why don't you ask Srila Prabhupada? So then So I said, no, I'm not going to do that, because who am I? I'm just, some insignificant person. I said, I don't want to disturb Prabhupada. He's got a whole worldwide society that he has to manage. Why should he worry about what I'm going to be doing? So that's the way I was feeling. So then Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, no, he said, but if Prabhupada tells you what he wants you to do, he said, then you don't get any, you won't be mental about it anymore. You'll know this, you'll be happy, and you'll know exactly this is what Prabhupada wants me to do, and you'll be able to do that with enthusiasm. So it'll be nice. So I said, anyway, I said, that's maybe, but I'm not going to ask him. So then the next morning, Prabhupada called me in about maybe 5 o'clock, 5:30. At that time, actually, this was about March the 11th in 77. We were in Mayapur. And Prabhupada had been very, very sick for the whole festival. He didn't come down, just the first day. And then after that, he was so sick that he was actually, we had to put on a 24-hour watch to be with him. His whole personal schedule changed. He didn't eat anything for 6 days. We had, a lot of problems. We had to call the doctor. Some emergency things happened. So he was very, very sick. So I had put off saying anything, about my personal situation until he improved. Then after the festival, Bhakti Churi Maharaj came on the party, and he was helping, and Navi Yogendra, he was also helping. So there was more support coming in. Then Prabhupada started to improve a little bit. So then I thought, well, now this is the time. There's, other people here that are experienced. And, this is, if I'm going to do it, then this is the time to do it. So that was when I brought it up with him. So anyway, I went in the next morning at 5:30, and Prabhupada asked me to massage him whilst he was sitting on the bed. Because previously we always did the oil massage at noontime, and then there was an evening massage at 10 o'clock, which was a dry massage. But because of his illness, then the schedule completely changed. So then he asked me to massage him at 5:30 in the morning. So I'm sitting there massaging him on his bed. And then he said, so, what are you going to do? So then, I'd been thinking about it, and, I got my plan, somehow or another, get Prabhupada to agree that I can stay in India. And then if I'm in India, I'm not very far away, and then it'll be easy to come back on the team again. And but there was something else going on inside me, which I really didn't want to come out, and I was kind of suppressing it. Anyway, so I started to say to Srila Prabhupada that, well, I was thinking, I should stay in India because I've got a British passport. So in those days, Commonwealth citizens, you didn't need a visa to stay in India. And it was a huge problem for us that all the Americans and Europeans, they would come to India, and then after 3 months, the visa would run out because they could only get 3 month tourist visas. And then they'd apply for an extension and get another 3 months. And then after 6 months, they'd have to leave. So it's very expensive, all these devotees coming and going, with this visa problem. So anybody who had a Commonwealth visa, means British or Canadian or Australian, then we could just stay there because no visa required. So it was, I was thinking, as soon as I, remind Prabhupada I've got a British passport, he'll say, yes, definitely have to stay in India, right? Nothing. He didn't say anything, no reaction. So I kind of, that's the first one down. And then my next point was that I said, of course, I could go to any temple, but Giriraj is going to start doing some college preaching. And I knew Prabhupada really wanted college preaching too. He's very keen on that. So I said I could always go down to Bombay and join Giriraj with the college preaching. Nothing. No response. Prabhupada was sitting there, but he wasn't responding to my prompts. And something else was going on in his mind. And actually what had happened before I started saying that, he said, go and call him, meaning Tamal Krishna. So before we started talking, Tamal Krishna, I called Tamal Krishna in. He sat down. And he said, so he wants to leave me. What should he do? Like this. So then Tamal left. He said, well, like I said, I guess he could do anything. There'd be, I think any temple in the world would be happy to have Harisori, join them. but he didn't give anything specific. So then, that was when he asked me, all right, you know. And then I started with my prompts, you know, stay in India, go to Bombay, do college preaching, nothing. So then, this other thing that was going on inside then suddenly popped out. Because during the festival, a few weeks before, Bali Mardan was there, and he had just been made the GBC for Australia. So one day, kind of half joking, he'd kind of come up, oh, here's Harry Sawrey, he's an Aussie. You know, if you ever want to come back to Australia, I'll give you a ticket, right? But he was only half joking. So anyway, this was this was internally, this was starting to come up to the surface, and I was desperately trying to avoid it, because I knew if I leave India, and especially if I go, you know, someplace like Australia, that'll be it. There'll be no chance of coming back on the party. So I didn't want to say it, and I was desperately trying to avoid saying it. But after I tried my, you know, the bait with the visa, no visa required, and staying in college preaching in Bombay, and nothing happened. And then this thing just forced its way out of my mouth. I mean, I really didn't want to say it, but it just forced it, you know, I think it was just Krishna just forced it out of my mouth. I said, well, of course, I could always go back to Australia, like, just like Bali Mardan had offered me a ticket to go back. And as soon as I said the word Australia, Prabhupada sat up, he said, yes. He said, Australia. I was just thinking the same thing myself. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj burst out laughing because of the way it happened. He saw what was going on. And that was it. That, you know, I gave him you know, his midday massage, and that was the last massage. And off I went. And that was Srila Prabhupada. He didn't want you hanging around. He wanted you busily engaged. It was not like, okay, you're off the party, have a break for a couple of days, and then go. It was like, all right, now go. Immediately go. Now it is decided. And then, you know, I realized from that Prabhupada had spent 18 months training me. It wasn't just that he was receiving, you know, this service, massage and personal service, and that was it. But he expected us to learn what he was doing, how he was doing it, you know, the principles of devotional service from his own personal example, and then execute it, then go out and do it. And so he didn't really want us hanging around, you know, except for a purpose. And when he felt that you'd learned that purpose, then you had to actually go out and show that you'd learned something. And once you were out, you know, when Harikesh took sannyas, I remember he was lamenting, because I'd gone in the room with him to give his, he was getting his sannyas clothes and everything. And he was lamenting, because he was in the same fix that I later on was in, was that you wanted to be with Prabhupada, but Prabhupada wanted you out preaching. So you wanted to please him by doing that, but you kind of got caught, you know, in this dichotomy. Anyway, so he was lamenting that, you know, that's it, now I'm finished, I'll never be able to come back on the party. Everybody knows, once Prabhupada sends you out, you never come back. So I was thinking about that the following year when I was leaving the party, and I was thinking, no, I'll get round it somehow, I'll stay in India, you know. But, you know, Prabhupada had another idea. So I was sent to Australia. And then, of course, you know, 1977, Prabhupada's health got much worse. And we ended up at the end of the year. I had come back for the month of October to be the visiting secretary, because the GBCs, they could book in for 1 month. And there was a permanent secretary and a visiting secretary. So I booked in for October. And then when I came, of course, at the end of September to join the party, then the decision was made in Bombay for Prabhupada to go down to go up to Vrindavan. And then he was there for that last 6 weeks. So I stayed for that month. And again, I was caught in this dilemma of wanting to be with Prabhupada personally, but knowing, you know, that he wanted us out preaching. And so one evening, about mid-October, I was with Prabhupada alone and to get a resolution to this conflict that I was in. I asked Srila Prabhupada that I said, you know, now that you're ill, I'd really like to serve you personally. And, you know, if you want, I can come back and stay with you and look after you. So then Prabhupada said, no, he said, I want you there for now. He said, later on we'll see, but for now he said, I want you there. Means Australia. So that was it. He didn't want me back on the party. Even though there was probably more need at that time than before, but he wanted me preaching. And then I was happy. I was kind of satisfied in my heart that I'd got my instruction. And so when I left at the end of the month, you know, I didn't feel as bad as I might have, because I knew that this is, Prabhupada wanted me, you know, away preaching rather than being with him. And that was the mood that I saw him, you know, several times with his personal entourage, that we were only there to get trained up so that we could go out and do something on his behalf. So, you know, service in separation for Prabhupada was a lot more important, you know, than him having us there, you know, on the spot personally serving him. So from a practical point of view, I experienced that. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that was really good.
Oh, there's some more questions here. All right, I have to get my glasses. Okay, this is a question. Is it possible for grand disciples to have a relationship that was shared by Prabhupada's disciples? Is that right? I'm taking it that means, is it possible for grand disciples to experience the same kind of relationship? Whose question was that? Yeah. Is that what you're asking? Inasmuch as that we're serving Prabhupada's movement, we're serving, you know, his instructions, we read his books, then we experience, you know, a contact, direct contact, personal contact with Srila Prabhupada. At the same time, Prabhupada is physically removed from us. And although, you know, as we've just said, that serving the instruction is more important than serving the personal form, at the same time, the realization of the instructions, how to enact them, comes about by, you know, direct contact, by personal contact. If that were not true, there would be no need for a parampara. Yeah, Krishna would just speak his instructions to Arjuna, and then forevermore, anybody could just read the Bhagavad Gita and, you know, become Krishna conscious. But it doesn't happen like that. What happens is that due to the force of time, gradually we get more and more distant, yeah, from the speaker. And the way that we stay in touch with the speaker, how do we experience Krishna, is through Krishna's living representative, yeah, by getting association with the representative of Krishna. So there's a parampara system so that there's always a living representative, yeah, on the planet. And then by their personal association, then you get experience and realization of what the previous acharyas and Krishna himself was teaching. If we didn't have that, then we would have a much less chance of understanding what Krishna consciousness actually is. So there has to be, as Prabhupada said, and as I've been saying in my seminars, a living Bhagavatam. We need the direct and immediate association of devotees to be able to get trained up and to be able to practice Krishna consciousness. So we experience, you know, the previous acharyas through our present association by enacting, you know, their instructions. And, you know, we get help from them. Just like Srila Prabhupada, when he was living in Vrindavan, in the Radha Damodar Mandir, this is probably around about 1960-61, when he was first starting work on his Bhagavatam commentaries. Then Srila Prabhupada had a direct personal experience of Rupa and Sanatan Goswami and Jiva Goswami actually came to him and instructed him, gave him instructions about how to write the Bhagavatam, his purports. But Prabhupada never claimed that now I have a direct relationship with Rupa and Sanatan Goswamis. Yeah. Although we're called Rupanugas. We're all, in our line, everybody is considered a Rupanuga or a follower of Rupa Goswami. So Prabhupada had that experience, but he never, you know, used that to kind of dispense with the rest of the disciplic succession. That now I have a direct relationship with Rupa Goswami, I don't need anybody else. No. He had his Guru Maharaj, he had his Guru Maharaj, he had his. And Prabhupada was very, you know, strict keepers in that parampara system. So similarly, we can, you know, and of course nowadays, we have an advantage, you know, that we can see Srila Prabhupada, we can hear him speak on tape. You know, there's so much recorded material, so many photographs. We don't, you know, it's practically unprecedented. We have never heard the voice of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Yeah, with his books are there, and some photos are there. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there's some photos. And previous to that, we don't really have, you know, there may be some paintings or something, you know, of some of the previous acharyas. But nowadays, I mean, we, in one sense, have that direct experience. We can see Prabhupada on film. We can, you know, see how his body language, how he's speaking, hear the intonation of his voice on his tapes. You know, it all has a very deep resonance for us. But at the same time, we shouldn't think that then that entitles us to think that we now can be direct associates of Srila Prabhupada without going through the parampara system. That is a mistake. It's a big mistake. But it's easy to think that way because of the, you know, multimedia presence, if you like. But the spiritual parampara system works and continues to work in exactly the same way. So we experience Srila Prabhupada's instructions. You can experience Prabhupada's instructions, the benefit of that, by, you know, serving in the way that Prabhupada requested through the parampara system. Not, as he said, just, I remember when, in 1973, when we were I was only in the movement about a year at that time, and it was just becoming a little bit of a fad for some devotees to start reading Bhaktivinoda Thakur's works. And we actually, you know, had some debates in the temple about how to do devotional service because some devotees, you know, were reading Bhaktivinoda Thakur's works and then quoting, but Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this, you know. And because they didn't have the experience to know how to apply what he said anyway. But it made a conflict. And then it was brought to Srila Prabhupada's attention when he came in 1973. And then Prabhupada told these devotees not to read Bhaktivinoda Thakur's books, but to read his books, and then they could understand Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So it's a similar kind of situation. You know, we have Prabhupada's books, we have his tapes and everything else, but in practical application, and just to be spiritually accepted by Krishna, you have to go through the parampara system. He is recommended that. And if you try to abrogate that, then you can't please Krishna. So I don't know. Does that answer your question sufficiently? Yeah.
Could I throw in just...
Yes, Maharaj. Go on right there.
No, it's okay. It's all right. One of our God brothers was telling us just a few months ago, it was August, that he had an experience with Srila Prabhupada, Dear Ashanta Prabhu from England, someone asked Prabhupada about that. There's a verse in the second chapter of the Bhagavatam about serving the Bhagavans.
you know, by rendering service, by regularly attending Srimad Bhagavatam class and rendering service to the pure devotees, the two Bhagavats. So the devotee asked Prabhupada, which is more important, the book Bhagavat or the person Bhagavat? Prabhupada said, the person Bhagavat, because he can pull your ear.
Yeah. So when you're with some in the physical presence of a devotee, it's a very good point. You can be corrected. If you're just reading the books, you can think that you understand something, but you may actually be filtering that through your own thought processes and your own desires. But when you have the presence of a pure devotee that you can associate with, then he can be on the spot to point out when you have a misunderstanding. So it's a very vital ingredient in making spiritual progress.
So your problem is a direct question in terms of what you're talking about. Because many times the body say prophet say this, prophet say that, but you know, we're not familiar with the time, place, and circumstance within which prophet was making that instruction.
Mm.
So how do we differentiate between what's applicable outside of the situation, like now, as opposed to what could just have been then? I mean, it's just prophet books and lectures that we can, you know, take up now. What about these conversations and letters?
Everything is there. I mean, you know, that Jadwaita Maharaj, he wrote something, I think, explaining the relative importance of different features of Prabhupada's preaching. So he was saying that number one importance is Prabhupada's books. Then we may say that next is Prabhupada's letters, yeah, because again it's a written thing. And then we may say conversations, because the spoken word is not always, you know, as accurate as when you sit down and write something. When you write something, it's more precise than when you speak it. So in that way, he was giving some kind of order of importance, if you like. Actually, they're all important. And when you're dealing with Prabhupada's instructions, you need to check to see that you have the right understanding of them. Because Prabhupada's not here anymore. And like you say, there's a question of context. So it's very easy to take some instruction from any of those sources, like a letter or a conversation, you know, or from Prabhupada's books even, a purport, and then misinterpret it or misunderstand it because you don't know what the context is for whatever reason. So it's just like sometimes we used to get people, you know, they would say, oh, Krishna's in my heart. I don't need to, you know, take any notice of you guys. Krishna's in, you know, is in my heart, you know, the same as anybody else's. I can just, you know, get instruction from him. Well, if you're a complete pure devotee, yeah, you can. But if you're not a pure devotee, no, you can't. Because Krishna may be giving you so many instructions within your heart, but are you capable of understanding it properly? You know, our hearts are distorted with our material desires. So the tendency is that we hear some instruction and then interpret it to suit our particular desires. Yeah. So that can easily happen, whether it's, you know, the source is the super soul or the source is Srila Prabhupada. And therefore you need advice and help and association with those who have, you know, many years of experience. And who may have had direct contact, you know, with Prabhupada, so that they can give you, you know, a proper understanding, or they can tell you whether your understanding is actually proper or not. So, you know, Vaishnava association is very, very important. Again, it's that living disciplic principle that's at work there. You need the association of advanced senior devotees so that they can actually guide you and help you to realize whether your realizations are correct or not. Is that all right? Is that, yes?
I was wondering if Prabhupada meant
Well, he made heaps. It's all in his books. Prabhupada stressed again and again, he who is the disciple today is the guru tomorrow. Yeah. He said it many, many times and consistently. Prabhupada started talking about having his disciples become gurus in 1967. And in 1977, he was still saying the same thing. He was consistent all the way through. He never changed his mind. Because that's the tradition. That's actually, you know, how things work in Krishna consciousness. There's a chain of, you know, disciplic line. All right, let's go on with another question here. Can we please Srila Prabhupada with other services as much as he is pleased with book distribution? yes. And no. I mean, this question used to come up a lot with Srila Prabhupada, you know, so, because Prabhupada would push book distribution so much, and he would always say that, you know, if you really want to please me, this is the only way you can please me, distribute my books. But that doesn't mean that then everybody who's not out on the street selling books is not pleasing Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada also, you know, wanted first-class deity worship. He wanted first-class prasadam. He wanted the temples to be kept sparkling clean. So many different items of devotional service are there. And although he, you know, he wanted book distribution to be there as a priority, he also told us many times that the quality of the service that you do, any other services, is just the same. Yeah, and we were just reading last night, actually, Prabhupada was giving a lecture, and he was saying, don't think that the person who's worshipping the deity, he should not be thinking, oh, this man is a gardener, he's just out in the garden. He's not as important as me, I'm directly worshipping Krishna on the altar. He said, no, the service that the man is doing in the garden is exactly the same, equal to the service as the man on the altar. Because it's all for Krishna. Same with the person who's cleaning the floor, it's all for Krishna. So the quality, spiritual quality of any kind of service, if it's being done for Krishna, is the same. And it's all pleasing. At the same time, there are certain activities which are required to fulfill the desire of the Lord, and especially for preaching. Book distribution was, you know, the priority that Srila Prabhupada established for our movement. He wanted that more than anything, because without books, books are the basis, as he said. So without book distribution, then you don't get anything else. When we were in London, this was July 26 in 1976, and Bhagavan Prabhu, he had just come from France with the first French Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, part one. And he presented that to Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was very, very happy to see that. And then he told us, he said, you know, I never stressed on temples. He said, my Guru Maharaj, he never stressed on temples, he only wanted this. He said, and because I took this seriously, he said, my Guru Maharaj said, these, you know, these other men, he was criticizing his disciples because they do not produce any number of books. He said, so I took that very seriously. He said, I was never interested in opening temples, but I took this very seriously, this instruction, to produce and print and distribute books. So then Bhagavan said, well, but now it seems like you have both, books and temples. And Prabhupada smiled and he said, yes, he said, temples automatically. He said, if you're doing this book business, then the temples will come automatically. And then, of course, temple means so many other services, but the basis of it all was books. So it's a fact that Prabhupada stressed book distribution again and again and again. And, you know, that was the one thing that he wanted to see maintained in our society. If we stop doing that, then we're in trouble. Big trouble. Yeah, book distribution, books are the basis. But you can please Krishna, please Srila Prabhupada by all the other services. He's very pleased. I remember when I was a new devotee in Sydney, And there was one girl, Ambika. She got initiated at the same time I did. So she made some halava. So that halava was sent into Srila Prabhupada, I guess for his lunch. And then Prabhupada, when he tasted the halava, he said, "Who has made this halava?" So then they said, "I am Bika." So he said, "Bring her here." So she came into his room. He said, "You made this halava?" She said, "Yes, Srila Prabhupada." She didn't know what he was going to say. He said, "This is very nice." He said, "You have pleased your spiritual master." He said, because you have pleased your spiritual master, you will go back to Godhead. Yeah, just by making some halava. Yeah, so, of course, that means you have to keep on pleasing him. It's not that one time you do and then, yeah. But, you know, this is the thing, is that the spiritual master is very pleased whatever service that is done for him. Another time, we were in Mayapur, and there was this whole Grihastha Sannyasi conflict going on. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj was kind of like the, you know, the main proponent of the anti-Grihastha lobby. And his thing was that the temples were mainly for brahmacharis and sannyasis, and that the women and the grihasthas, they should all live outside and take care of themselves. You know, that renunciation is the principle of our movement. So if you have so many women around, then it's not possible to have a nice, mood of renunciation. So he was pushing this. He was a sannyasi. It's natural. But then, he had a conversation with Srila Prabhupada, and then he went off. And then he was telling Srila Prabhupada, he said, "Since I've taken sannyas," he said, "I never speak to a woman like this." He was very staunch. Prabhupada was saying, "Yes, very good," like this. And then after he left, I said, "Well, Srila Prabhupada," I said, "you know, his not speaking to women, isn't that like a material consideration?" And then Prabhupada said, "Yes." He said, "But does it mean that he is not a devotee?" So he corrected me because I was being a little critical. And then I had brought one of the ladies, she'd made like a bookmark, a nice fancy bookmark. Simple thing. But she gave it to me and asked me to give that to Srila Prabhupada, and I'd given it to him, and he saw it. He liked it. It was very nice. So at that moment, then he picked that up and he looked at it and he said, so nice. He said, "I have never stopped them from doing service simply because they are women." So even a simple thing like making a bookmark, but Prabhupada accepted that. You know, this is also devotional service. So one other example. There was a lady, the Bengali ladies in Mayapur, in 1977, they used to go out early in the morning, and there were flowers growing all around the park next to the lotus building. So Prabhupada had just taken his breakfast, gone to the bathroom, washed, and he came out and he looked over the balcony, and there was one Bengali lady there picking flowers. And she had a basket and she was just picking flowers. And he smiled, he said, "Just see?" He said, "With every flower picked, she goes one step nearer to Godhead. Just picking flowers." So everything, you know, Prabhupada was pleased to see everything. He told Bhavananda, actually, when we got to Mayapur, he saw this big field full of flowers. He said, "These flowers, this is your first success." Yeah, not book distribution, flowers. But, so you can please Prabhupada in many different ways. But if you don't distribute books, you will displease him, I can say that. Yeah, if book distribution were to cease, then Prabhupada would not be happy with that at all. It has to go on. So, let's see, another one. We understand that... what's that, Maharaj? Can you read me? Oh.
Shoot! Gayatri. Is that what it is? It should be chanted. Oh, right.
We understand that Gayatri should be chanted while the deities are awake. What did Prabhupada do? I never heard that, actually. Maybe that's one of the pujari things. I was never a pujari. But I used to enjoy sitting in Prabhupada's room with him, chanting my Gayatri as he chanted his. And twice it came up, when was the best time for chanting Gayatri Mantra. One time I had asked him, that is the best time chanting 6 o'clock in the morning, noon, and 6 o'clock in the evening. So Prabhupada said, yes, that's all right. Or he said, immediately after bathing. Then a couple of months later, we were in Mayapur, and Madhavisa Swami was there. He asked the same question, you know, when is the best time for chanting Gayatri? And again, Prabhupada said, he affirmed the best time, he said, was immediately after bathing. Because they asked, should we chant straight after Mangalarati, or just on sunrise when the sun is coming up, and then, you know, noon and then sunset? But Prabhupada said, no, he said, this after bathing, this is the best time. So, and that was Prabhupada's habit. In the morning time, after he'd finished doing his translation work, a night, you know, all night long he would translate, then around about Mangalarati time he would stop, he would relax a little bit. Then he would go and he would wash, brush his teeth, freshen up in the bathroom, come back out, he would sit down, then he would put on tilak, fresh tilak, and then he would immediately chant his Gayatri Mantra. And then again, his noon Gayatri, actually, he used to do that after he'd had his massage, then he would have his bath, and then put on fresh clothes. So then by about 1:15 or 1:20, then he would sit down, put on his tilak, and then he would chant his midday Gayatri. So Prabhupada's preference for chanting Gayatri was immediately after bathing. When Prabhupada and yourself traveled together, which places did you like best and why? The best places, of course, were Vrindavan and Mayapur. There's no question of that. In fact, when I first joined Prabhupada's party, it was at the end of November in 75, and I'd been the temple commander in Vrindavan for several months, and then I'd come into Delhi just for the day on some private business, and then somehow or another I got hooked into, you know, giving Srila Prabhupada his massages. Then from Delhi we went to Kurukshetra for a day, which was also very nice, actually. That was my first chance to travel with Srila Prabhupada and look around Kurukshetra. I'd never been to Kurukshetra before. In fact, that was an interesting trip, because we went out in the morning by car. It took about 3 hours, and Ambarish Prabhu was with us. He had just given Prabhupada $150,000 to buy some land and to begin construction of a Varnashram college in Kurukshetra. And Prabhupada had come to Delhi, actually, with the intention of meeting this man called Gulzarilal Nanda, who had been a former Prime Minister of India, temporarily. When Shastri died, this man was made the temporary acting Prime Minister, and I think he'd also been the acting President at one time. Very important man. He was retired, and he had gotten a huge government grant for developing the Kurukshetra area. So he knew Prabhupada, and Prabhupada wanted to get some land there. So he came up November 25th up to Delhi, and Nanda was supposed to come and see him in Delhi and make an arrangement for them to both go to Kurukshetra and look at the land there, see what was available. So Nanda came after a few days, and then on the 1st of December we actually drove up to Kurukshetra. So I'd just come on the party at that time to do the massages. And so that was on the 29th, on the 30th of November, I was giving Prabhupada his massage on the roof of the place that we were staying in Delhi. And Gopal Krishna came up, and he asked Srila Prabhupada, now who's going to Kurukshetra, because we'll need to get the vehicles organized. So then Prabhupada immediately said, he can go, pointing to me. And Gopal was surprised, because I just kind of, I was casual, right? I wasn't actually on the party at that point. He said, Harry, sorry, Srila Prabhupada? And and then Prabhupada said, well, I have to have my massage. Yeah. So that was it. I was, you know, I got to travel. I was really happy, first chance. So we went to Kurukshetra, Prabhupada spent the morning looking around, and we visited different spots that Nandaji was hoping Prabhupada would buy. And Prabhupada didn't want to buy, he wanted him to give it. So, but politely he just said, well, you know, we'll think about it, you know. And we looked here and there. This was all around the Brahma Sarovar area. Brahma Sarovar is the big, big bathing tank. It's about two-thirds of a mile long and about a third of a mile wide. Huge. And Nandaji was constructing walkways and steps all around for bathing ghats. And they spent a lot of money there. He also had a big statue of himself erected. Right? About 15 feet tall. Huge thing. Like this. Prabhupada commented afterwards, he said he's put one big statue of himself, but nothing, no, not a single deity of Krishna has been installed. At Kurukshetra, of course, is Krishna's place, not Nandaji's. But anyway, he said, let the crows pass stool on his head. But anyway, so we looked around Brahma Sarovar, and then Prabhupada went back to the motel that we were staying at, and Nandaji came, they had a chat during Prabhupada's massage, and then he went off, and then after Prabhupada had his lunch, then he was invited to go to Kurukshetra University. So he had a look around there, and he left some of his books there. Then he came back, so then about maybe 3 or 4 o'clock, that section of the trip was over, and Nandaji, you know, bade farewell to us. He went off to do his work. And then it looked like we were going to go back to Delhi, but then Prabhupada had a discussion with Harikesh and Ambarish, and Chaitaguru was there. And he said, now there's this other place, Jyotisar, which is about 7 miles further on. So why don't we go and look and see that place also? So we were all excited, and off we went. We went to Jyotisar, and we didn't have Nandaji with us, and his whole entourage, so there was no pressure on us. We were able to look around and see, you know, there was a much smaller lake there. And then there was a very nice deity of, half-life-size deity of Krishna and Arjuna on the chariot with the four horses, white marble. Very nice, under a big banyan tree. And that was said to be the spot where Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. At least that's what they say. And so we looked around, and somehow or another we felt, you know, the energy there was more enlightening. And so then at the end, after about 15-20 minutes, then Prabhupada said, so what do you think about this place? So then Harikesh kind of put it in succinct terms. He said, well, Brahma Sarovar was like the heavenly planets. He said, but this place is like Vaikuntha. So Prabhupada smiled. He said, yes. He said, this is very nice. He said, so now, Chaitaguru, you try and get some land from the government. They can donate some land for us here at Jyotisar. And we'll also try to get some land there at Brahma Sarovar. But he said, here, he said, we can build a temple of Krishna and Arjuna. And there we can have the Varnashram University. So then we went off back to Delhi. And we got back about 9 o'clock at night. So then after half an hour or so, Prabhupada had his milk, and then he went to take rest. So then I was massaging him, giving his evening massage, and then Prabhupada was lying very silently, and then he said, so? He said, how did you like Kurukshetra and Jyotisar? Oh, no, he said, how did you like Jyotisar? So I said, well, you know, it seems to be very nice. I mean, I was a complete neophyte. I didn't know anything. Prabhupada's asking me, how did I like it? So I said, well, it seemed to be very nice. And then Prabhupada smiled. He gave a little hmm. And he said, yes. He said, Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita there. And then he went off to sleep. So it was nice. A little exchange there at the end. So I enjoyed that trip because it was my very first trip with Srila Prabhupada. But as I say, Vrindavan was always wonderful to be there with Prabhupada. I spent a total of 4 months with Srila Prabhupada, living in his quarters there, and because there were a lot of pastimes that went on there. But after the first trip from Kurukshetra, the next day we went to Vrindavan for about 8 or 10 days. Then we came back to Delhi, so for about 2 days before going to Bombay. So whilst we were in Delhi, I was giving Prabhupada his massage, and then he said, "So," he said, "how do you like Vrindavan?" So again, I didn't really know what to say, so I said, "Well," I said, "at least I can tell it's different from Delhi." So Prabhupada smiled. He said, "Yes." He said, "That is Krishna's dham." He said, "That is the best place." So that was nice. And 3 or 4 months later, we were in Mayapur. And again, this was the first time I was with Prabhupada in Mayapur. I'd visited the first time the year before. But now in 76, I was with Srila Prabhupada. And I saw that Prabhupada was visibly more relaxed. You know, I was giving him his massage at about 10:30 in the morning because the sunshine was coming through onto the veranda at that time in the morning. So he had his massage a little earlier. And then he was just sitting on the veranda. And after lunch, every lunchtime, he would come out after eating and he would sit down on the veranda and he would look across the fields and look over towards the Ganges and just relax. It was very, very nice. Really sublime. Myself and Tamal Krishna Maharaj was there, so we would come and we would sit down at Prabhupada's feet and he would be sitting in a chair like this. And, you know, he would just chit-chat and look out over the fields. And I saw Prabhupada was very relaxed, more so than I'd seen him. And so I suggested to him that, you know, this would be a very nice place to retire. And Prabhupada smiled. He said, "Yes." He said, "Either here or Vrindavan. No other place, that's for sure." So he, because he naturally liked the two dams. And there was a few nice little pastimes. One time he was came out and he was sitting, and then all of a sudden he said, "I had a dream last night." He said, "I dreamt of a planet where pious Mohammedans go." And that's all he said. So we kind of, me and Tamal, we laughed. And I was, you know, we would, you know, because there were several thoughts that I had. You know, one was, is there such a place? And is there such a thing as a pious Mohammedan? Because, you know, they like to kill cows, you know. Anyway, so I asked Srila Prabhupada, I said, "Well, is there such a place?" And he smiled, he said, "Oh, yes." So whether, I don't know, did he, you know, did he go there? Did he see it? Or, you know. But it's just nice. It was just like a little throwaway line that he put in there. And another time, he was sitting and then I had a silver cup. So I knew that after lunch, he would, you know, after a few minutes, he would like to have a little glass of water. So I had the glass there just in case. I was always prepared. Prabhupada was sitting. And then sure enough, he said, "Oh, give me a drink." So I moved forward and I was so eager to try to give him this cup of water that I moved too quickly. You know, it's a kind of a, like a clumsy guy and, you know, a bit gross. So I moved forward and I grabbed the glass, but I tipped it with the palm of my hand and it started to go over. So then I grabbed it to stop it falling. And the tip of my finger just, I caught the lip, but my nail just touched the water. So then, you know, I got in a dilemma. I was thinking, now my fingers touch the water, it's contaminated. But then if I have to throw the water out, the tap's at the other end of the veranda, I'll have to go over and make Prabhupada wait till I get more water. You know, so that'll be an offense to make him wait. Then I was thinking, you know, but then if I offer him this water, it's contaminated and he might not want it. Then that'll be an offense too. So I was kind of caught between the two and I had to make a... And Prabhupada was sitting there watching me. And I'm sure he could see what was going on in my head, you know. He was just sitting there waiting to see what I was going to do. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj was sitting. He was also watching. So I had to make a decision. So then I made, you know, the sudden decision, all right, I'll not make him wait. I'll give him this and chance it. And as soon as I lifted it up, Prabhupada shook his head like... And he said, "You are simply a malacha." And he quoted this verse, "Pravittim chad, navrittim chad, janana vidurasura." Yeah. the asuras, they do not know what is to be done and what is not to be done. And then he left. So I had to go off and, get the water. Anyway, a few little things, nice things in Mayapur. And Brindavan also, we had a lot of nice pastimes. So I think that, on the whole, I liked being with Prabhupada in those two places, the most. Apart from that, everywhere, was wonderful. When you travel with Prabhupada from one place to another, it was a continuous festival. Wherever you went, then naturally hundreds of devotees would come from all over, except in India. They never did that. But everywhere else in the West, because they only got to see Prabhupada once a year, so there'd be these huge receptions, for Srila Prabhupada. There was a few notable ones. The first chance I got to travel with him internationally was on April the 18th, 76. We left Bombay and we had to fly to Melbourne. So it was a very long trip. We flew to Singapore. Then we had a stopover in Singapore, about 3 or 4 hours scheduled. Then there was some delay with the aircraft, so another 3 hours. So we ended up being delayed there, 7 hours. And that was a little difficult because in those days, Singapore had probably one of the worst airports in the world. Now they have the best airport in the world, Changi. But in those days, they had an old military airport. And, it was very poor facilities. And they also were very inimical to the devotees. They were banned and were still banned. So when we arrived in Singapore, myself and Srila Prabhupada, we traveled first class and Pushtakrishna, he was the secretary, he was in economy. So that was the standard. Prabhupada was always given a first class ticket and the servant had to be with him, so he got a first class ticket. And then everybody else on the party, they would be in economy. So when we flew in, we were there for 3 hours, or 4 hours, and so we wanted to use the waiting lounge, first class lounge. But somehow or another, the way they'd arranged it was you had to actually go through immigration to get to the lounge. It was on the other side of the immigration desk. So they saw, his Srila Prabhupada were all dressed as devotees. Sorry, Hare Krishnas are not allowed in Singapore. So they actually refused Prabhupada entry. So we're standing around. There were no seats. There's nowhere else to go. And we had 4 hours. So then Pushtakrishna went up and he showed them. He said, we have first class tickets. We're entitled to stay in the first class lounge. We're here for 4 hours transit. So he haggled with them for about 10 minutes at least. Then finally, they agreed to let us go through, to the first class lounge. So they let us in. And then the first class lounge turned out to be a pub. Right? Fortunately, it was closed when we first got there. So we went in and there was just us there. And I think we had a little prasadam and we had a tiffin box. So Prabhupada took some prasadam. And then after about an hour, the doors opened, the lights went on, and they opened up for business. So all people started coming in and they're all boozing and smoking. So we had to go out. This is the first class lounge, right? So they just had these plastic, the old style plastic bucket seats. As uncomfortable as anything. It's like sitting in a, the bulldozers have those, cup things at the front. Is like sitting in one of those. So we had to just sit there. We had no choice. And then 3 hours delay. So it was very difficult for Srila Prabhupada. Then we flew off in the night flight to Sydney. And then Sydney, we had a 1 hour transit. And then another hour or so's flight to Melbourne. So by the time we got to Melbourne, there was a funny incident actually on the aeroplane. Because in the middle of the night, because we were in the first class, we had the very front two seats right in the nose of the aircraft. The pilots were up behind. And they had the, movie screen. So in the middle of the night, they showed a movie. So it was right there in front of us. me and Prabhupada, we were up at the front, so we couldn't avoid it. And we were sitting there and this movie comes on. And then it's some war movie with David Niven. David Niven was a famous actor in those days. And so, there's this whole scene where they're storming this hillside. right? And he goes running up and he's shooting and everything, and he gets shot. So he collapses. Then he jumps up and he runs again, and then he gets blown up. And then he goes down in a heap, and then he jumps up again and he runs again. And then again he gets shot. He goes down, and then again he gets up like this. So we're looking at this, it's right in our faces. There's no sound, right? We're just seeing the thing. It looks completely ridiculous when you see them, a movie without sound. And after the third time he got shot, Prabhupada turned to me, he said, "Still alive?" It was very funny. And then he just turned away and he chanted his japa for the rest of the time. So anyway, so we arrived in Melbourne, and we'd been on the road for 22 hours, with all the transits and all that stuff. So we got into the reception hall before we went through immigration, and then we went to get our baggage. So we were in the baggage hall, and then of course there's the customs desks, and then on the other side then there's the arrival hall, so that the doors are opening and closing as people are going through. And when we came into the baggage hall, I could see this is going to take about half an hour to get the bags through. So we decided that myself and Srila Prabhupada should go straight through, and Pushyakrishna would get the bags and he would bring them through customs control. So we went up. The customs agent looked at our, you have to sign those landing forms. So because we had no experience of traveling with Srila Prabhupada, what we'd done, I'd filled out Prabhupada's landing card, and where it says number of baggage, I'd put one suitcase. So as soon as he saw there's a suitcase, then he said, "So where's your suitcase?" So he said, "Well, that's just coming. This is his Prabhupada's secretary. He's going to bring all the cases." So he said, no way, you're not coming through. He asked, it's on the form, he has to come with his own suitcase. So I got in an argument with the guy. I mean, a real argument, I started getting really agitated. And I started telling him, Prabhupada's 80 years old. I said, "There's no seats in this baggage hall." I said, "We're going to have to wait for half an hour. We've been traveling for 22 hours. Prabhupada's 80 years old." I said, and apart from that, I'm the one who packed his suitcase. I'm his personal servant. So I packed the suitcase. So I'll bring it through. You just let, you let Prabhupada through." No way. Like this. I was getting really angry with the guy. So, it got really heated. And when we really started getting into it, and I was, started yelling a little bit at the guy. Not really loudly, but loud enough. And getting really angry with him, and then a little crowd gathered around to see what was going on. Here's somebody, this Hare Krishna's arguing with the customs officer. So Srila Prabhupada just walked away. He didn't say anything. He didn't tell me to stop, but he just very discreetly walked off to the side and was just minding his own business. I was having it out with this customs guy. And then, the customs guy just stormed off. He got angry and I was left there, standing there fuming. And as I'm standing there, then a policeman comes, police sergeant, and he comes up and he said, "What was all that about?" So then I explained to him, we just want Prabhupada to go through, without his bag. And I gave him the whole thing again. And then he said, He said, "Will all that stop if he goes out?" So that was, there were 60 devotees on the other side of the doors having a Wampa Stompa kirtan. Right? And there was, Guru Kripa was there. He'd just become the GBC and he was famous for these really, energetic kirtans. So, every time the doors opened, somebody went, left the customs hall to go out, the doors would open up. All this, wall of noise, Hare Krishna, come booming through. And then when the doors closed, then it would recede again. But you could hear it, above all the airport noise. And, they were drowning out all the airport announcements. So it was a big problem. And they tried moving them away from the doors, and still it wasn't, you know, it didn't have any effect. So actually it was funny, because when Prabhupada heard the chanting, he looked at me and very innocently he said, "This is our men?" It couldn't have been anybody else. They said, "This is our men?" So anyway, this police sergeant, he said, "Will all that stop if he goes through?" So I said, "Yeah, definitely." So immediately we called Prabhupada over. He went up to the customs guy, and that was it. Prabhupada went straight through. I mean, they can do it if they want to. Yeah, all the rest is just bureaucracy. Anyway, so then Prabhupada went through, and as soon as he went through the doors, the devotees spotted him, so the kirtan like doubled, you know, when they saw Srila Prabhupada. And then, you know, after about a minute, then it stopped, and they took him into the VIP lounge. So, you know, it was very, very wonderful to travel from one place to another, and you'd have these big receptions. Everything was like a festival wherever you went when Srila Prabhupada arrived. There was one other funny incident that happened, actually. After he'd gone through, then me and Pushyakrishna got the bags. So I got Srila Prabhupada's suitcase. And Prabhupada, you know, everybody's seen that big winter coat that he used to wear with the fur, you know, fake fur, it's not real fur, the furry hood and everything. So I packed that, you know, in the suitcase. So when I got the suitcase, I came up to the customs counter, and I went to a different guy, not the same guy. So when I walked up, I was kind of apprehensive, what's going to happen now, you know, maybe I'm going to get arrested. But the second guy was very nice. He'd seen what had been going on, so he was determined, you know, to welcome us. He was a nice man. And he said, you know, "Okay, don't worry, this will just take a minute, no problems, and then you'll be on your way." And so he unzips Prabhupada's suitcase, lifts up the lid, and one of these huge cockroaches, about, you know, 2.5 inches long, leapt out of Prabhupada's suitcase and onto the counter. And I thought, oh no, you know, now we're for it, you know. They say, and the customs guy jumped back. He yells out, "Quarantine, quarantine," like this. And he thumps this big red button, right, on there's a post at the end of the counter with a big red button on it. He hits the button and then this klaxon goes off, rah, 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 like this. And there's lights flashing and he's yelling, "Quarantine, quarantine," like this. So then a couple of guys come running up and they've got these big cans of bug spray. two big ones like this. So then, you know, in the meantime, the official that had on the suitcase, he whips off his shoe, and then the poor old bug's ringing around on the counter, bang, like this, kills the bug on the counter on the spot, puts his shoe back on, right, takes the two cans, and then he smiles at me. He said, "Don't worry, just take a minute," and he, shh, like this. And he emptied both cans into the suitcase, then slams it shut, seals it off, and he says, "Hope you have a nice stay in Melbourne." <Like this. laughs> So that was... Anyway, so that was Melbourne. That was the Melbourne arrival. The other notable arrival was when we got to Los Angeles. We had been in Hawaii for a month, and then we flew out, and... I guess it was about a 4 or 5 hour flight to LA, and we got in late at night. So actually when we left Hawaii, there was another delay. We got on the plane, we were sitting there, and then there was some more problems, some mechanical thing, I think. And so I think it was either 1 hour or 3 hours, I can't remember now, but it was a substantial amount of time. We had to just sit there. So everybody's just sitting around, so they started serving out drinks. Because we were in the first class cabin, so they started giving everybody free champagne. So naturally, after half an hour, an hour, they're all getting a little, you know, tipsy. So they're all laughing and joking and, you know, kind of milling around. Srila Prabhupada's just sitting there, you know, chanting on his beads. And then, you know, there's a couple behind us and they're laughing and giggling like anything. you know, and they burst out laughing. Prabhupada turned and looked at me and he said, He said, what have they got to laugh about? You know, materialists, right? They're all, what have they got to laugh about? So anyway, we flew off. So we arrive in LA, we taxi in, we come to the door, and then they don't open the door. Everybody's standing and waiting and waiting, and it's like, you know, 5 minutes and then 10 minutes, and everybody's wondering what's going on, why they're not letting us off the airplane. So we're also standing there waiting. Pradyumna and Pushyakrishna were there, and myself and Srila Prabhupada. And then finally they make an announcement. They start to open the door and they make an announcement. And they said, due to some problems in the airport, in the arrival lounge, we're having to divert all the passengers through another tunnel. So when you go out, you know, you go this way, we'll show you. So then they let everybody out. So they start going out, so then we start going out, we start to follow them, and then they stop us and they say, no, not you, you go this way. Right? So to the regular way. So just the four of us, we go, and then when we come in to the arrival lounge, we see why they had to divert everybody. There's 500 devotees in the arrival lounge, and they're having this huge kirtan, and they all go berserk when they see Srila Prabhupada, you know. And they put about, you know, 7 or 8 garlands on Srila Prabhupada. I remember one huge garland came all the way down to his ankles. And then we went in, you know, in procession through the airport. So all the delay was they were trying to figure out how to get all the other passengers out without going through the Hare Krishnas. But they didn't, you know, they didn't announce that over the thing. They just, no, you go that way. So, and then when we went through, they had this huge kirtan and the devotees were like jumping up and down, practically bouncing off the walls. You know, Prabhupada had this huge smile on his face and he put his hand up and everybody went crazy, you know. So it was wonderful. You know, at least 500 devotees were there to greet him. And then when we arrived at the LA temple, we pulled up at the curb there and they had a red carpet, you know, from the curbside all the way up into the temple room. So Prabhupada got out and walked up the red carpet. And then as we came in, because they have a mezzanine floor, so all the ladies were up on the mezzanine there with these baskets of, you know, rose petals and flowers. And as Prabhupada came in, they started throwing heaps and heaps of flowers. It was like walking into a blizzard. There were so many of them. You know, and Prabhupada would just, you know, had this huge smile on his face. It was, you know, very, very wonderful. So like that, you know, most temples that we went to, we got some kind of reception like that, at least the big temples. New York was the same thing. You know, about 300 devotees greeted Prabhupada at the LaGuardia airport. And as we walked through, we had to have a police escort so that we didn't, you know, make too much congestion and the other passengers could pass by. And the devotees from the Bhakti Rasa theater group, they were all dancing. They were doing all these fancy dances in front of Srila Prabhupada. They were dressed up in costumes. And they were throwing flowers out as Prabhupada was walking. So he was walking along on a carpet of rose petals. So the whole airport, you know, we look behind, there's this huge trail of rose petals all through the airport. I mean, in those days, nobody, you know, nobody cared. I mean, the devotees didn't care. Prabhupada was there. That was all that mattered. So they'd jump over the security barriers and everything. But nowadays, of course, you can't do that. You know, you'd get shot if you did anything like that. I mean, literally, you'd get shot if you did that in America nowadays. But in those days, you could go right with Prabhupada all the way up to, you know, the door of the aircraft, practically. I remember we did that several times in Melbourne. And actually, when we left Melbourne, I forgot this bit. When we left Melbourne, again, there was this big group of devotees going with Prabhupada, having a big kirtan. You know, we checked in, and then we were going through the corridors. And then he had to go down this quite a big escalator. And so as Prabhupada stood on the escalator and started going down, all the devotees started running down the up escalator so that they could keep keep abreast with him. So as he's going down, they're all running down the up escalator. And Prabhupada, you know, Prabhupada was completely serene. He was smiling. Yeah, very nice. And Prabhupada, you know, as much as we were outrageous, Srila Prabhupada was outrageous. He just, you know, he would, you know, he'd be very happy to see the enthusiasm in the devotees. So it was just very wonderful. Anyway, so that's a little bit. Which places did we like the most? What else have we got here? Okay, how did Srila Prabhupada relate to his disciples? Was it in awe and reverence on their part, or as a friend? Okay, that's a good question. Actually, there's one of our God brothers, Sri Ram Prabhu. He just left his body on New Year's Eve. He was an old friend of mine. He had very serious physical problems ever since I'd known him. Sorry. He had had so many different kinds of problems. He always had problems with his lungs. I think as a youth, he had this condition where his lungs would collapse regularly, and they'd have to rush him to the hospital. I think he told me his lungs had collapsed about 30 times, yeah, when he was in, you know, like in the space of a few years. So he was always very poor health. And just at the end of this year, he was hospitalized. About 3 years ago, he had a serious stroke, which left him partly paralyzed. And he's basically been bedridden ever since then. And then apparently in December he got much worse, and they had to rush him to the hospital, and he was in with kidney failure, heart failure, lungs, pneumonia, and he was on a life support system. Then somehow or another he seemed to improve a little bit, and then they brought him out and they actually let him go home. And Kidiraj rang him on December the 12th, and he said he was in good spirits despite what was happening. And he sounded, you know, he said unexpectedly strong. But then at the end of the month, then around about the 28th, again he got pneumonia, and it came on very strongly. So they were going to put him back in the hospital, I think about the 2nd of January, but anyway, he didn't last that long, and he left his body on, I think, the 31st. They just had his funeral yesterday. Actually, in, I think, Sacramento. Anyway, Sri Ram was an old friend of mine. And in 1982, I was sent to New York as the GBC. And Sri Ram was a regional secretary, and that was when I first met him. So just as a kind of a treat for the devotees, I spent a couple of weeks reading from my diary. In those days, of course, I hadn't got, you know, the book out. I just had my original handwritten notes. And so I thought it'd be nice for the devotees just to hear some, you know, more intimate pastimes of Srila Prabhupada. So after about a week, Sri Ram came to me and he said, you know, when you're reading your diary, he said, I find it really disturbing. And I was surprised. I said, why? I said, don't you like hearing about Srila Prabhupada? He said, well, you know, my impression of Srila Prabhupada has always been very at a distant. He said, I've seen him on the Vyasasan, and, you know, maybe on a morning walk once or twice, but I've always seen him in a very, very formal setting. And, you know, that's just the way that I've always appreciated him. And now he said, you know, you're saying all these things about happening in his room and these exchanges and, you know, he said, I just find it very difficult. I can't relate to it, you know, because I've always seen him in this kind of awe and reverence mood. So I said, well, what can I do? I said, I mean, you know, this is also Srila Prabhupada. So anyway, then a few years later, we both happened to be living in, about 10 years later, we both happened to be living in Los Angeles. And I had finally gotten the first volume of my book, actually, you know, edited, and it was ready to go to press. And they had a system they had the ISKCON review board in those days. So any book that was to be sold in ISKCON temples had to have a stamp of approval from the ISKCON review board. So Sri Ram, he was a member of the review board. And so I gave it to him and I asked him to read that and then, you know, give me your approval. Him and Purnachandra. So they both read it and they came back and they said, this is fantastic, you know, definitely. So I got the review board approval and we printed. And that first volume came out in 92. So anyway, then by that time he'd had a chance to think about it. And, you know, when he read it again, he said, oh, you know, this has really enhanced my relationship with Prabhupada now. You know, he started appreciating more of the intimate pastimes that were going on. So most devotees, they had that kind of awe and reverence mood, naturally. And when I first joined Srila Prabhupada's party, I also had that mood. I gave the example about the first night that I went into Prabhupada's room in New Delhi. So he'd been eating, and his plate was there. He'd just finished eating. And there was also a basket of fruit that somebody had given him during darshan, which was underneath his table. So when I came in, Prabhupada called me over. He said, now, he said, this plate, you have to take that and get it washed. And this fruit, you can take that to the temple, and it can be offered to the deity. So I picked up Prabhupada's plate with one hand, and I picked up the basket. It was in a basket of fruit, in the other hand. And then Prabhupada stopped me. He said, what is this? He said, I've been eating from that plate. It's contaminated. Now you're picking it up, and then you're picking up the basket of fruit that is to be offered to the deity at the same time. And he just shook his head. He said, Malecha, you know. He said, go and wash your hands, and then come back, wash the plate first. Then, after that, you can take the fruit to the temple. So my mood was that here's Prabhupada's plate. He's just eaten from that plate. There's Prabhupada's remnants on that plate. And now I'm going to pick up Prabhupada's plate. So I'm getting purified. Yeah, that's the way I was seeing it. That I'll be getting purified just by handling Srila Prabhupada's plate and then taking it and washing it. So I was in that mood of awe and reverence. But Srila Prabhupada, of course, he was thinking, I've just eaten, this is contaminated. Now this rascal's picking up the fruit that I want to offer to the deities, and he's contaminating that as well. So that was unacceptable. So the first thing that I learned, very first night, was that when you're on Prabhupada's party, you can't be in so much awe and reverence, yeah, that, you know, you can't function. Prabhupada has certain services that he needs to be done. And you have to, the servants have to see things from Prabhupada's point of view, not their own. So it meant sometimes doing things that we would not ordinarily do, because Prabhupada wanted them to be done. An example of this was when Pushtakrishnaswami came on the party as secretary. So he joined in March. He'd been on the party about 2 months. And then we had gone, after Melbourne, we went to New Zealand, and from New Zealand, we went to Fiji. So we were in Fiji during the very end of April. So he wasn't at the GBC at that time, but the main man in Fiji, he was an Indian man, older man. His name was Deoji Punja. He got initiated on that visit and became Vasudev Das. And his brother became Kashanji, he became Bur Mohan. So anyway, they had organized everything. A couple of years before, they had met our devotees, they heard about Prabhupada, and they got very excited. So they invited Srila Prabhupada to come from Australia and come and visit them in Fiji. And they wanted to start an ISKCON center. They wanted an ISKCON center to be opened in Fiji. Upendra had previously been there and done some preaching also. So Prabhupada went there and then he told them, if you want a temple, you have to build it. So they're very, very rich men, the Punja family, practically one of the richest families on the island. So they started building this temple and they started collecting a huge amount of money. And when Prabhupada went in 76, we did the foundation stone ceremony. So they had arranged for some other programs. One program was on another island, and it would involve a half-hour flight. And then another program was some other part of the island, which was, you know, a fairly long drive. And then there was another program in a hall, which was not so far away. So when Pushta Krishna started going over the program, the schedule, with Vasudev, and he heard about, you know, these distant programs, he just got right on his case. He said, no way, Prabhupada's not going to fly. You know, you're crazy if you think Prabhupada's going to fly to another island. You know, it's so much disturbance. Why are you making these kinds of programs? You know, we should just do something locally and that's it. So Vasudev didn't know what to say. And, you know, naturally he'd already advertised and made so many arrangements. So, it was, you know, it was going to be an embarrassment. So I saw what was going on. Guru Kripa was in there as well, and they were both getting on Vasudev's case. So I didn't think it was very good. And I didn't think that Pushta Krishna's reasons for why he was chastising him was good either. So when Vasudev came out, he was kind of like shaken. So I went up to him and I told him, I said, look, I said, he's wrong. I said, you go now and see Srila Prabhupada and discuss it directly with Srila Prabhupada. So he did that. And as soon as Prabhupada heard that, you know, they were trying to stop these programs, then immediately he said, bring Pushta Krishna. So Pushta Krishna came in. And because I was the veteran on the party, I'd been on the party 4 months. He'd only been on the party 2 months. So I felt confident that what I was doing was okay. Although he was a sannyasi and the secretary. They were supposed to be the boss. Anyway, I knew this was wrong. So Prabhupada, sure enough, he said, bring Pushta Krishna. So when Pushta Krishna came in, he said, what is this? He said, why are you stopping all these programs? So then he said, but Srila Prabhupada, he said, your health's not that good. And, you know, we don't want to inconvenience you. You have to travel to other parts of the island and this other island. So he said, I just don't want you to be inconvenienced. So then Prabhupada told him, he said, inconvenience is there just in traveling, in preaching. He said, we have already accepted the inconvenience just by coming here. So he said, now, he said, whatever programs he arranges, you facilitate. So that was it. Because Vasudev did actually cancel the one that was involving the flight to the other island. But it was a valuable lesson for Pushta Krishna. He had taken this role of being like a protector, you know. He was thinking that his business as the secretary was to protect Srila Prabhupada, you know, from too many, you know, engagements or too many people coming, you know, to make sure that Prabhupada's health was okay and that he wasn't troubled too much. But he didn't understand that when you were traveling with Prabhupada, you had to give up that mood of, you know, awe and reverence, service, protection, and adopt Prabhupada's mood, which was, we've accepted the inconvenience, gladly. Even though we knew that Prabhupada would become ill sometimes from doing so many engagements, we still had to make the arrangements to facilitate it, because that's what he wanted. So, you know, it could have been a little, you know, kind of like a dilemma, that you were doing things that you knew would actually cause inconvenience for Prabhupada. But because he wanted it, you had to do it. So it was a different mood on the party than if you were off the party. And at the same time, when you were with Prabhupada, then very often, you know, you'd be in like very casual situations, informal situations. Prabhupada would talk, sometimes he would laugh and he would, you know, tell a little joke or something, or even his disciples would tell jokes and Prabhupada would laugh and he would have this nice exchange, you know. But there was always a limit to what you could do and say. We never forgot that Prabhupada was our spiritual master and that we were there to serve him. And so even though he allowed us a little intimacy, and, you know, he would chit-chat. Sometimes he would tell us about his boyhood. You know, he'd tell us about the days of the British Raj or, you know, so many different things. And it would, you know, personally, I really enjoyed being in Prabhupada's room, just talking with him. And I remember Hari Kesh was always a little bit hung up. Somehow or another, he couldn't quite relax whenever he was with Prabhupada. And he actually told me afterwards, he said, I was always envious of you because you were always so, you know, Prabhupada and you got along so well. He said, but I never was able to feel like that, you know, that kind of relaxed kind of mood. He said, I was always envious of the fact that you were able to laugh and joke with him and stuff. But anyway, the point was that, you know, there was a little leeway in the relationship. It wasn't like you're so awe in reverence that you couldn't speak or do anything. You know, when you were with Prabhupada, then, you know, there was a nice relationship. And it was, there was, you know, friendliness in the relationship. But at the same time, you have to remember that you weren't an actual friend that you could then do as friends do, like Krishna's friends. You know, they wrestle with him and throw him down and, you know, tease him. And no, this is, you know, the guru-disciple relationship has to remain intact. And there was one time when I actually transgressed that. And that was in 1977 in February, just before I left the party. And Srila Prabhupada had been invited to go and do a program at Mahesh Pandit Samadhi, which is kind of halfway between Calcutta and Mayapur. And Prabhupada's health was very bad. He was getting weaker and weaker and weaker. In fact, when we arrived in Mayapur one morning, he told me, he turned to me one time, he said, never in my life have I felt as weak as I do now. So I saw many symptoms. So, you know, I just wasn't very keen on Prabhupada going out and doing what I thought was small-time programs. So this man had, you know, invited Prabhupada to Mahesh Pandit's Samadhi. We'd seen it. And then we went to Mayapur. A few days later, this man turns up and he wants to make a pandal. And he wants Prabhupada to come, you know, to this pandal. And we knew it was going to be a very small time thing. It was a small village. They'd probably get a couple of hundred people and then, you know, be villagers. So I just didn't think that it was very significant, certainly not significant enough that Srila Prabhupada had to personally do it. And so I suggested, you know, to Srila Prabhupada, I kind of complained actually, that Srila Prabhupada, why do you have to go and do this program? I said, we've got so many sannyasis here, you know, they can easily do the program. But Prabhupada said, no, he's asked me, so you know, I've agreed I have to go. And I said, but Prabhupada, I said, what about your health? It's not good. And he said, no, he said, it's all right. He said, I've said and I'm going to do it. So then later in his room, I went back and it was really troubling me. And I just couldn't accept that Prabhupada, you know, was going to do this program. So I went in and I said, Srila Prabhupada, I said, why do you have to do this program? You know, and so he said, you heard the story about Aniruddha when he was fighting on the battlefield. Then he was knocked down and then his driver took him off the battlefield. And then he ordered his driver, now you take me back, you know, into battle after he recovered. Then you immediately take me back. So then I said, but, you know, it was his driver's duty to take him off the battlefield because he was injured. Then Prabhupada said, and it was his duty to immediately return like this. So then that should have been it. I should have accepted that. That should have been it. But then I started to say, but, you know, then I said, but Srila Prabhupada, I mean, and then Prabhupada just put his finger up like this. He didn't say anything, he just put his finger up. Stop. Because I wasn't accepting that Prabhupada had made the decision and it was his decision to make. I'd gotten in the same trap that Pushyakrishna had fallen into in Fiji, thinking that I was there to give him some kind of protective relief. Whereas Prabhupada, you know, he's the preacher. He decides what goes and what doesn't. So I actually realized I abrogated that guru-disciple relationship by trying to force my opinion onto Srila Prabhupada and try to push him into something that he didn't want to do. So I realized, and I, you know, I offered my obeisances and I stepped back from that. So there was a little leeway. Prabhupada, when he was faced with making major decisions sometimes, he would ask for advice from his disciples. It wasn't that, you know, Srila Prabhupada, because he was, you know, our absolute acharya, that every single little thing, he would simply speak it and we would simply do it. No, he would actually call us in, he would ask for our opinion and advice sometimes. There was one time when we were in Vrindavan, and there was a whole thing going on about the Vrindavan management. Akshayananda Swami was there, and he was a sincere man, but he was a hopeless manager. And Prabhupada used to get really frustrated whenever he went to Vrindavan because of the state of the management. You know, all small things, but you know, several times he complained about the deities not wearing garlands when they were when we went down to greet them. Somehow or another, the devotees didn't get it together to get the garlands made. Or then when the garlands were on, they were made from really, you know, bad quality flowers. And Prabhupada would have to personally deal with the flower wallet to make sure that he got good quality flowers and we didn't get cheated. One morning especially, we went and we greeted the deities. And when Krishna and Balaram's curtain opened, they weren't wearing garlands again. And Prabhupada was so disgusted, actually. He turned around to Akshayananda. He said, "This is another farce like this." So it was a trial. Going to Vrindavan, Prabhupada would have to, for weeks, he would struggle to try to get the standards up. And then Akshayananda wouldn't be able to do it. And then Prabhupada would get really frustrated. He'd get a little angry. And then after the anger, that also wouldn't have any effect. Things would remain the same. And then afterwards, he would just, you know, kind of give up. And then he'd just joke about it. So Harikesh was there as the secretary. And he had previously been the temple president in Vrindavan in like 73 or 74, before the temple opening. And then he'd been removed and sent somewhere else against his wishes. I think Dhananjaya had turned up one day and said, "Well, Prabhupada just sent me here to be the temple president." And Harikesh didn't know anything about it. So then he was out. Yeah. So Harikesh was now back in Vrindavan as Prabhupada's secretary. And he was seeing the frustration Prabhupada was having with different items that were going on there in the temple management and the guest house and this and that. So he was interfering as Prabhupada's secretary. So he was also stirring things up a little bit. And the devotees were getting a bit annoyed with him because he was a very passionate guy and very opinionated. And Hansaduta was there. And Hansaduta, you know, he kind of left Germany under inauspicious circumstances and taken up a new service in India as a traveling sannyasi. But then he decided to camp out in Vrindavan, and he'd been made the co-GBC of Vrindavan with Gopal Krishna. And they weren't getting along at all. And so Hansaduta was also another very radical person. He would just get these ideas in his head, and then he'd turn the whole place upside down, you know. And anybody that didn't agree with him, that was it. They were given the boot. You know, he'd break into their rooms, take out their luggage, throw them out, you know, whatever. So he was a very radical person. So he had his own opinions about Vrindavan management too. And then, of course, there was Gopal Krishna, who was supporting Akshayananda because he was his long-standing, you know, temple president, and they got along quite well together. And they were a pair. And Prabhupada, when he was in his joking mood about it, sometimes he would imitate Gopal and Akshayananda. Don't mind. If there's any disciples of Gopal Krishna Maharaj, you know, here, don't mind. It was all in good humor. So when Prabhupada would get to the frustration stage and then the joking stage, then he would complain to me in his room. I remember one day he was complaining to me in his room about Akshayananda and Gopal. So they both had their mannerisms. So Gopal Krishna's thing was that everything is first class. Right? No matter what it was, everything is first class. And Akshayananda's thing was that whenever Prabhupada challenged him, you know, why this is like this and why he didn't do that, he'd say, because we're all fools, Srila Prabhupada. Yes, Prabhupada, you're quite right. We're all fools, like this. And that's the way they were. So then Prabhupada couldn't get past this, you know, these barriers, right? So then in the end he would just joke about it. And he will say, because we're all fools, Srila Prabhupada. He would imitate Akayananda, right? And then, and he will say, oh, everything is so first class, Srila Prabhupada. So it was like Prabhupada was really frustrated. So he was thinking about how to rearrange the management there. And, you know, there were all this infighting going on and disagreements and criticisms. Sansaduta was criticizing Gopal and Akayananda, and Harikesh was criticizing, you know, Hansaduta and the other two, and they were all criticizing Harikesh for interfering when he wasn't part of the management. So anyway, Prabhupada was trying to figure out, you know, how to improve the management and what to do with everybody. And there was a certain point that he got to with Harikesh where he just decided that he had to go. He could see he wasn't properly engaged as his secretary. We were sitting down there in Vrindavan. It was a small place and he needed a big field because he was an intelligent guy and he was very, you know, passionate. So a big man in a small pond, you know, it was too difficult to deal with. And he made a couple of mistakes, you know, in his secretarial duties. So at one point, Prabhupada just suddenly decided, without discussion, that was it. Harikesh had to go. Right? So then he ordered him to go back to Eastern Europe. Harikesh was devastated, you know, because he didn't want to get off the party. But Prabhupada told him, that's it, you have to go. And at the same time, he was so frustrated with Akayananda that he finally actually decided to change him. But then he was trying to think who could replace him. And Hansaduta was saying that, you know, he was convinced he could do a good job like this. So Prabhupada was thinking about all these things, how to engage all these different men. So 1 o'clock in the morning, one morning, buzzer rings. So I jump up and I ran in Prabhupada's room. He was up on the roof. And Prabhupada, I came in, offered my obeisances. Prabhupada looked at me and he said, I want your advice. So I was immediately like really surprised. You know, I was thinking, you know, how can I advise Srila Prabhupada? So Prabhupada, seeing my, you know, surprise and reluctance, then he, just to reassure me, he said, no. He said, after all, he said, you do have a British brain. So he was reassuring me because Prabhupada's experience of the British were that they were good managers, whatever else they may have been, but they, when they were in charge in India, it was very, very well run. So to Srila Prabhupada, you know, I had a British brain. So he wanted my advice on this managerial, you know, matter. So when he said that, then I had to, okay. So then he asked me one by one, what do you think about Akayananda? What do you think about Hansaduta? What do you think about Harikesh? And I gave my, you know, opinion, advice. And then Prabhupada heard it and he said, all right, thank you. And then he sent me back to sleep again. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. And then the next day he actually did it all. He took, you know, I mean, he actually executed the whole thing. He made Akayananda his secretary. Hansaduta was put in charge of the temple. And with Harikesh, he was allowed to continue on the way back to Eastern Europe, which was, you know, all the things that I'd suggested. However, after about a couple of weeks, Hansaduta had created so much havoc that Prabhupada could see he can't do it. So then Gopal and Akayananda had come to Srila Prabhupada and complained, you know, he's doing this and he's doing that. The temple had about 80 devotees in it when he took over, and after 2 weeks there was about 45 left. Not because they'd all, you know, blooped or anything, but because he'd sent them out. He sent, you know, two or three off to Turkey, some off to Afghanistan, you know, this way. Yeah. So then Prabhupada saw that, you know, he's just too radical. He was sincere, but he's just too radical. So then he changed it back, and he made Hans Deduter his secretary and put Ekoyananda back in charge, even though Ekoyananda actually couldn't do the job to his satisfaction. But anyway, so, you know, when you were on Prabhupada's party, sometimes you were in that situation. Prabhupada would call you in and ask you for your advice. You know, or he would call the sannyasis in. Or he'd call all the GBCs in and he would discuss it with them and ask them, now what do you think about this? How should we do that? And he would listen very carefully. He took it very seriously. Because his was the final word. Yeah, whatever Prabhupada decided, that was what we did. But still, he was involving us in the decision-making process. Not that he just, you know, I'm the acharya, you do what I say, bang, finish, no discussion. No, there was lots of discussion. So the relationship, you know, there was a kind of aspect of friendship, but the awe and reverence, you know, was also still there. We always, remembered, Srila Prabhupada is our guru, and we're his disciples. We're here to serve Srila Prabhupada and not the other way around. Or, you know, we shouldn't imagine that now we're developing a familiar attitude with Prabhupada. And that was a downfall for several servants also and secretaries, that after spending some time with Srila Prabhupada, they became overly familiar and they forgot who he really was. And then they fell down. It happened, you know, when I was with Prabhupada, it happened with one of the secretaries that was traveling with him. And previously, there were many instances. So you had to be very careful. There's a thing that Prabhupada says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that the servant, the personal servants of the deities and the spiritual master have to be very careful. Because the idea is that you're dealing with fire. So if you deal with the fire nicely, then you can get warm. But if you mishandle it, then you'll get burnt. So those that don't know how to deal with the spiritual master or with the deities in the proper way, it's better for them to stay at a distance. Yeah, it's better to stay at a distance. Okay. It's 10 to 10. How long do you want to go for? Well, I'll be happy to continue. You know, there's a few more questions, but it's up to you at what time you want to do that.
Yeah, I guess.
Or not.
I guess tomorrow morning. We should do that.
All right.
We could start maybe a little early, instead
of the morning walk or something. Okay. So, tomorrow morning then, we'll try and answer the rest of the questions. There's still quite a few to go. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
I saw you move
jai.